Welcome, everybody. Today's program is going to be mostly mathematical. Preparations for doing quantum field theory on curved space-time. The plan is that we will study functional derivatives, so differentiation with respect to functions rather than respect to numbers. And then we will do two examples of applications of that. We will apply functional differentiation to the quantum field theoretical Schrödinger equation that we discussed early in the course. And the second example will be to apply the functional differentiation to define the functional Legendre transform. We will need the Legendre transform, the functional Legendre transform in quantum field theory on curved space for a very particular purpose. The reason is that field theory can be written in both Hamiltonian formulation and in the Lagrangian formulation, and we will need both. The Legendre transform gets us between both of them. The Hamiltonian formulation will be suitable for quantization because there we will have fields and canonically conjugate fields. So this is the natural way to introduce commutation relations, but it's not covariant. But if you want to do quantum field theory in curved space, obviously we need to be very careful that we do things covariantly. So we will also have to work in the Lagrangian formulation to make sure that we have covariance. So the functional Legendre transform will allow us to go back and forth the two formalisms. Okay, so functional differentiation. Let's remember differentiation of functions of just one variable. So here's the famous Newton-Leibniz formula for differentiation. It's to take that limit. That is easily generalized to the case where we have many variables, even countably infinitely many variables. So let's say f is now a function not just of one variable u, but let's say it's a function of a lot of variables. And let's write that as a set of variables. That's why they are curly brackets. And the variables are called uj, and the j is running from 1 all the way to infinity, let's say. So countably many variables. In this case, we have partial differentiation. We can differentiate this function f with respect to any one of its variables. Remember, f here still is only just outputting one number. But the inputs can be infinitely many numbers. So the partial derivative of a function of many variables with respect to one of them, let's call it ui, and I could be any one of those variables, is obtained by generalizing the Newton-Leibniz formula, and I will first write it down in the obvious way, and then in a way that will be suitable for generalization to functional differentiation. So the obvious way to generalize the Newton-Leibniz derivative to partial derivatives is, of course, to just view the function as a function of the variable with respect that we want to differentiate with respect to, and the other variables are just spectator variables. They just sit around, nothing gets done with respect to those. So the partial derivative is obtained by taking that limit where we take f of u plus, and then we have the epsilon only added to the variable in question, the variable with respect to which we want to differentiate. And here's the f without any change in its variables divided by epsilon, limit epsilon going to 0. Now, here is another way to write the same thing, which, however, should be intuitive for generalization. We can write this partial derivative also as saying that we take the limit for epsilon going to 0 of that ratio here, and then we say f of the set of all those variables, and we add to this set of variables epsilon times the Kronecker delta ij. And here we just have f unchanged, everything is the same. This is just a convenient way of writing what we're doing up here, right? So we take all the variables and we add to them epsilon times Kronecker delta ij. If I is not equal to j, if j is not equal to I, so if it's not the variable that we are differentiating, then we're not actually adding anything. Only in one case are we actually adding an epsilon there. But you see, here we have u of j plus epsilon times Kronecker delta. That invites generalization to having a continuous set of variables over here and a Dirac delta over there. So we will define, in complete analogy to this, here we can see both, in complete analogy to this, we will define the differentiation of functions of uncountably many variables. So f is now depending on not just a countable number of variables ui, where I is running through integers. We now have f depending on variables u of x, where x is running through the real numbers, or even Rn. So on one hand, you can view this as f depending on an uncountable number of variables, where the variables are labeled by x. Or you could say that f depends on a function on Rn. Same thing. But if we view it as f depending on an uncountable set of variables, then it's natural to define the differentiation with respect to them by generalizing this, where u of x, where this becomes u of x, and this becomes epsilon of delta of x minus y. So the idea is that the functional derivative of f with respect to the function u of y, which you can also view as the partial derivative of f with respect to the variable u of u at y, defined as the limit epsilon going to 0, f, and then you put as its argument, it depends really on the function u of x, but you replace the function u of x by u of x plus epsilon times the Dirac delta minus the function unchanged divided by epsilon limit epsilon going to 0. I'm skipping here over a few technical issues here because the Dirac delta is, of course, not really a function. It's a distribution. But as we will see, these issues usually don't matter. We can treat it as a function. Essentially, the issue is that higher powers of distributions are not defined. And in principle, higher powers of distributions could come up here. But because we take the ratio with epsilon, we are picking out only what's linear in epsilon in the numerator here. And what's linear in epsilon is linear in the Dirac delta, and therefore it's going to be okay with the distributions. We'll see that come up explicitly in an example very soon. Just to remind you of what a functional is, a function takes variables as its input. A functional takes a function as its input, where the function can be viewed as an uncountable set of variables. Okay, so f is a functional, so it maps functions u over Rn into real or complex numbers. And to indicate that we are dealing with a functional rather than a function, one uses usually square brackets. Yeah?
So let's say, for instance, the function is taking a small function and giving us output in the square root of that function.
And sorry, what was the outputting? I didn't get
it. Functional?
Yes.
Takes a function and gives us the square root of the function.
Okay. So what do you mean by taking the square root of the function? That's not a number. You see, a functional outputs a number.
Not a function?
No. Okay. That would be an operator.
Okay. I was just concerned about how to take how to add the Dirac delta to take the differentiation.
We'll do an example of it.
Okay.
For now, think of f as something like the action, for example. The action is a functional. Put a function in there, get a number out. So here's a concrete example. I hope that answers your question. If not, ask me, okay? All right, so here's a function L, f of u. Of course, with the previous notation, if you wanted to be really accurate, we would tediously write down the set of all u of x where the x runs through Rn, right? So it depends really on all those variables, but the set of variables u of x, you might as well view as a function u of x. Okay, so this is a functional, and it's defined in this way. The integral over the real line, cosine of x times the function that you take as input squared, well, and you integrate over that, right? So you see, it's a functional. You plug in a function u of x, and you get out a number. It's a functional. Let us now differentiate it with respect to the function u of y. So what we get depends then on y. The choice of y is like the choice of which variable we want to differentiate. If we view u of y as a collection of variables, right? If y would be the index, but a continuous index. All right, so we want to calculate that functional derivative. According to the previous definition, it's the limit for epsilon going to 0, 1 over epsilon, and then we have to take that functional here, where we replace every occurrence of u of x by u of x plus epsilon times Dirac delta x minus y. So we do it here. We replace u of x by u of x plus epsilon Dirac delta of x minus y. And we have to square it because it occurs squared here. Minus the functional unchanged. That is the formula here, right? This one. We've replaced u of x by u of x plus epsilon Dirac delta, and here we keep it. All right, so that's that. Now there's a square to be worked out. If we spell out what this is, we obtain a term that's u of x squared, and then we obtain a term which is 2 times u of x times epsilon times Dirac delta, that's this one. And we obtain the Dirac delta squared with an epsilon squared. And we subtract this term here. So that gives us a u of x squared here. I put it all under the same integral multiplying cosine of x. What we see is that the constant term is dropping out, the u of x squared term, constant with respect to epsilon. We also have a term that's linear in epsilon, and that one going to be the important term. There's also a term proportional to epsilon squared. It's actually a problematic term because here we would have to have the Dirac delta squared, which is a priori not defined, not even as a distribution. However, no matter what it is, let's remember that we have here epsilon squared divided by epsilon, which means that epsilon will survive. And in the limit epsilon going to 0, it will suppress that term. It will go to 0 no matter what it is. So the only survivor in this is this term here. Epsilon over epsilon, that's just constant in epsilon. And we can carry out that limit. And well, first of all, we get that integral here. The limit epsilon going to 0 is no longer critical. And the integral will go away because it will be eaten up by that Dirac delta. So what we obtain is that it's 2 times cosine of y, u of y. So overall, what we have is that this functional, when differentiated with respect to u of y, did what you might expect the derivative to do. It reduced the power by 1, get a prefactor of 2, and it also got rid of the integral. Because of the Dirac delta. Got this, right? There's no more integral in this. But it ought to be like that because the functional derivative of f with respect to u of y should really depend on y. And yes, our result does depend on y. That's the sort of thing that we will do that you are probably already used to doing when you take the action and you calculate the Euler Lagrange equations. The action is just a number. But the Euler Lagrange equations depend on x. You get rid of the integral in the action by exactly the same means. So now similarly, One can calculate what the functional derivative is of this functional here, where we no longer just take the second power, but we take the nth power. You see, it's just f of y n times u of y to the power of n minus 1. The same kind of calculation goes through. We only keep the linear term in epsilon. That will give us just one Dirac delta. And that will get rid of the integral. That's how this would work out. So generally, functional derivatives on polynomials and suitable power series in a function work by removing the integral and reducing the power and producing a prefactor just in the usual intuitive way. Now, let me make a few remarks here. We worked with formerly an uncountable set of variables, u of x. It was just like the u index I, except that the index I was running through discrete, through integers, but x is an index that runs through the real numbers. Now, function spaces are vector spaces. What if we had worked with a different basis in the Hilbert space? Basically, we are working here in the position eigenbasis of our Hilbert space of functions. We could have chosen to work in a different basis of the Hilbert space, for example, a discrete basis, or another continuous basis. For example, we could have worked in momentum space. We could first work in momentum space. Fourier transform everything, the action or whatever the functional is, into momentum space, then functionally differentiate, and then Fourier transform back. Since they're all they are linear operations that actually will commute. But more interestingly, we could also work, we could do the same thing in the function space, but work with a countable basis. For example, the basis of Hermite functions, the eigenfunctions of harmonic oscillator. They too span the Hilbert space because by the spectral theorem, they are the eigenfunctions to a self-adjoint operator. So these eigenfunctions are also forming an orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space. But that would mean that we now have our functions replaced by little L2 sequences. The wave functions in the harmonic oscillator eigenbasis are just coefficients. You know, what is the coefficient in the ground state? What's the coefficient for the first excited state, etc. So what we then see is that functional differentiation with this choice of basis becomes ordinary partial differentiation. Functional differentiation viewed in this way is not really anything new. It's just an unusual choice of basis. And you may wonder, of course, how come? Isn't there a difference between countable infinity and uncountable infinity? They are very different infinities. How come, by the way, that in quantum mechanics, and this question goes beyond just this particular application, how come that the same Hilbert space that we work with has countable bases and uncountable bases? How can that possibly be? Now, the answer to that, just to go off a little bit on a tangent, is that the uncountable bases are not really bases. These so-called eigenfunctions are not in the Hilbert space. That's one part of it. But the other part of it is that if you remember, the eigenfunctions in quantum mechanics, and mathematically speaking, in the Hilbert space of square integrable functions, are not strictly speaking functions. They are equivalence classes of functions that differ only by other functions of measure zero with respect to the Lebesgue measure. And that quotienting out, that putting into equivalence classes of functions that differ only by functions of measure zero, that actually reduces the Hilbert space to a Hilbert space that's of much smaller dimension, namely that it's separable, it has a countable basis. So it's not that we perform a miracle here, that we found a countable basis for something that's uncountable. No, what's really going on is that we don't have uncountable bases in quantum mechanics. It just looks like it. Really, we have to form equivalence classes of functions that differ only by things of measure See, the PC wants to restart itself. They differ only by functions of Lebesgue measure zero. Okay. Now, example application of functional differentiation. The Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory. Remember that whenever we have a Hamiltonian, and we found a Hamiltonian for the quantum field theory, well, then you can write down a Schrödinger equation too. And for quantum field theory, that will be the functional Schrödinger equation. So let's view these things in parallel, quantum mechanics and quantum field theory. In quantum mechanics, we had variables q hat and p hat, and they had indices j, and the evolution was with respect to time. In quantum field theory, we have our degrees of freedom phi and the canonically conjugate degree of freedom pi, and we had plenty of them, technically uncountably many of them, one at every x. So x was our label here in the same way that in first quantization the j is a label of degree of freedom, degrees of freedom. In quantum field theory, the x was a label of degrees of freedom, and the time evolution is, however, again, with respect to time. One of the reasons why the Legendre transform will be so important and functional Legendre transform will be so important is that that's, of course, not a way to treat things symmetrically with respect to space and time. So we will have to go to a Lagrangian formulation. Anyway, so we have quantum mechanics of Q and P, labels, the index is J, and in quantum field theory, the index is X. In quantum mechanics, the Hamiltonian looks like this. It's the sum of the kinetic parts plus potentials. And in quantum field theory, analogously, we have a sum or an integral in this case over kinetic parts, all of the momentum squares half, plus what we might call potentials. In quantum mechanics, the potentials can be more complicated than that, because there could be magnetic fields, and then they would couple to P rather than Q, and so on. It could be more complicated. And in quantum field theory, too, generally there is at least something as complicated as that, where you could view the whole thing as a potential when you compare with quantum mechanics, but in practice, this part would not be considered part of the potential, but this would be considered part of the potential. So for example, W of phi hat could be a constant times phi hat to the fourth. That's a popular theory of scalar quantum field theory. Again, comparing quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, a complete set of commuting self-adjoint operators, and therefore a complete set of commuting observables, would be the set of the Qs, or the set of all the Ps, for example. And in quantum field theory, similarly, a complete set of commuting self-adjoint operators would be the phi hat of X. Remember, the point about this completeness is that if you know the, if you jointly diagonalize them, then you get a basis of the Hilbert space in such a way that the collection of the eigenvalues completely nails down which state it is that we are talking about. Here are these eigenbases. So the joint eigenbases of all the Q operators in quantum mechanics might be written like this, where the Qj are the eigenvalues. So this state, which is a joint eigenstate of all of the Q operators, has the property that if you apply one of the Q hat operators on it, then the corresponding eigenvalue out of that collection here is being produced. Similarly, in quantum field theory, you can look at states that are eigenvectors at the same time, jointly, they are all, this such a state is an eigenvector simultaneously to all of the phi hat operators. So if I take one of those phi hat operators, for example, phi hat at the point y, then, yes, this thing is an eigenstate to that operator, and the eigenvalue is going to be phi of y. Phi of y is a scalar function that we write in here. Okay, so every vector here, every Hilbert space vector here, every joint, every joint eigenstate of all of the phi hat, is characterized by a function on Rn. And that function on Rn tells us what the eigenvalue is that is being produced when a field operator acts on it. So if the field operator phi hat of z acts on that vector, then the eigenvalue that is obtained is phi of z, where phi is that function that characterizes our vector here. In quantum mechanics, what's a wave function? Well, let's say we have an abstract state in the Hilbert space, psi of t, abstract state. We have not specified a basis. And now we specify a basis. So we choose, for example, the joint eigenbasis of all the position operators. And then we calculate the overlap between the states that we actually have in the system and all those basis vectors in the Hilbert space, which together they span the Hilbert space. Usually, we would just write psi of q is overlap of q and psi. So that is the position wave function when spelled out with maximum tedium. In quantum field theory, very similarly, the state of the quantum system, of the quantum field, is some Hilbert space vector in the Hilbert space. And it has a wave function. It has a field eigenstate wave function, just like psi has a joint position wave function, just the psi of q. Here, every abstract state in the quantum field theory has a wave function, or actually wave function L. So the wave function L is this. Psi of phi, just like here you get to choose. Let me back up a moment. This is a number here, and what does this number mean? It means the probability amplitude for finding these particular numbers as the eigenvectors, as the eigenvalues, as the measurement values when you measure all of the q operators. So if you simultaneously measure all of the position operators, then you get a bunch of numbers. And this is the probability amplitude for finding this particular bunch of numbers. And similarly, in quantum field theory, if you could measure simultaneously the amplitude, phi hat of x, of a quantum field at all locations x, then you will get a bunch of numbers. At every point in space, you get another number. And psi of this is the probability amplitude for finding this particular bunch of numbers. This particular function phi of x. Phi of x is a bunch of numbers. For every x, it gives you a number. So the probability amplitude for finding the field, if you measure the phi hat at every point in space simultaneously, the probability amplitude for finding particular outcomes characterized by a function phi of x is given by the overlap of the abstract state in the Hilbert space of the quantum field and this joint eigenvector of all the phi hat operators. A simplified notation so that we avoid all those curly brackets here is to say in quantum mechanics that the overlap of the abstract state and a concrete position eigenvector, where this q stands for all of the qi's, is written as psi of q and t, where if we work in, let's say, three-dimensional quantum mechanics, it's implicitly understood that the q has an index I which runs from 1 to 3. And if we have several particles, then we know that the q's run through all of the x, y, z coordinates of all of the particles. In quantum field theory, too, we try to keep the notation as simple as possible. And so the wave functional is written as the overlap between the abstract state and then this state phi, where it is understood that phi is really phi of x. It's really an entire function, right? If you want to specify a particular state like that, you have to specify a function phi of x. Just like if you want to specify a position eigenvector, you have to specify the position, like three numbers, q1, q2, q3. You have to specify three numbers, you get a particular value. Here, you have to specify an uncountable set of numbers phi of x, which is really a function. Okay, and so the wave functional in quantum field theory, therefore, is you plug in the field configuration that you're looking for, the phi of x that you're looking for, and then psi is the probability amplitude for actually finding that. So you could, for example, ask the following. Imagine your quantum field is in a state psi of t, and you know what the state psi of t is, you've calculated it. And you want to know what's the probability that if I measure the amplitude of the field everywhere at once, I find that the amplitude is given by a function phi of x. What's the probability for finding this particular phi of x? Well, this is what tells you that. You plug in the phi of x and you get out the probability amplitude. Now further to the Schrödinger equation. In quantum mechanics, the Q and the P operators with the hats on them are abstract operators on Hilbert space. They are not tied to any particular representation. All we know about them is that they obey this commutation relation. But then we construct a basis in the Hilbert space, such as the position eigenbasis. For example, the eigenbasis of all the Q. If I don't put an index, it means all of them. And then when we do that, we get the position wave functions, as we just discussed, which are the overlap between the position eigenvectors and the abstract states. Then we can calculate how those abstract operators' action on the abstract Hilbert space vectors translates into concrete action on the wave functions. And you've gone through all of that. You know that the abstract position operator acts on a wave function by multiplying with the eigenvalue. Right? So it maps psi of x into x times psi of x, or psi of q into q times psi of q. And the abstract operator on the Hilbert space, and by abstract I mean not tied to any representation, this operator acts on an abstract state in such a way that when you look at it in the position eigenbasis, the psi of q wave function goes into minus I times the spatial derivative of the psi of q wave function. In quantum field theory, there is something very similar. Namely, in quantum field theory, we have the abstract phi hat and pi hat operators, and they are not tied to any representation. We know of them only, in principle, that they obey this commutation relation. But then we choose an eigenbasis for the Hilbert space. We choose a basis for the Hilbert space. Just like here we chose the position eigenbasis, the joint eigenbasis of all the qi, here we choose the joint eigenbasis of all the phi hat. And then we do it very similarly to here. Phi hat is an abstract operator in Hilbert space, but acting on abstract vectors. But abstract vectors in Hilbert space have concrete representations as wave functionals. Just like in quantum mechanics, abstract vectors in Hilbert space have concrete representations as wave functions. And then we can ask, well, the abstract operator maps abstract vectors into abstract vectors. But in particular, also their concrete representations into concrete representations. And this is what happens in first quantizations. This is what happens in second quantization in complete analogy. We have that the wave functional goes into the multiplication with respect to the independent variable times the wave functional. Phi hat is represented by multiplying with the eigenvalue in the same way that q hat is represented by multiplying with the eigenvalue. And just in the same way that in quantum mechanics, the momentum operator is represented as a differentiation operator with respect to q, here we have that the wave functional is being acted upon by the canonically conjugate momentum field by functional differentiation now with respect to phi. See, just we have the q eigenbasis We have function, we have the differentiation with respect to Q, we have the phi eigenbasis, we have differentiation with respect to X. Just think of the X as a label again, as an index. You will see that it's in complete analogy here. But still, I think it's a good exercise for you to check not only that the commutation relations between Q and minus ID by dQ are these, but also check now with the definitions that we had earlier today that the commutation relation between this operator acting on wave functionals and that operator acting on wave functionals is really this one. See, in principle, we have to verify that, that this is really a legal representation of these operators. And for that, we have to check that these operators obey the commutation relations that these abstract things are obeying. So now that we have that, we can do the Schrödinger equation. See, the Schrödinger equation is id by dt psi. And then here we have p squared over 2m, or p squared over 2, and v of q times psi. And the reason that it takes this form is, of course, that the p becomes minus id by dq. That's how we turn the p squared into that. And the q hat operator becomes multiplication with q. That's why the potential takes this simple form of a multiplication operator on these wave functions. And the quantum field theoretic Schrödinger equation very similarly takes now this form. We have I d by dt on the wave function L is given by the integral over, well, this used to be p hat squared. But p can be represented of a pi hat squared, pi of x hat squared. But the pi hat of x can be represented by functional differentiation, and we have now a second functional differentiation here. And the occurrence of the phi hat becomes simply multiplication with the phi, in the same way that q hats become q's in the position eigenrepresentation. But notice that this is now a new kind of equation. It's a functional differential equation. When we try to solve that equation, what we are looking for is a functional. We are looking for an object psi of phi, which is such that you can feed it an arbitrary field phi of x, arbitrary function phi of x, and it will spit out a complex number in such a way that this differential equation is obeyed. You may not be used to solving that kind of differential equation. In general, when there is a potential, then this functional differential equation can be solved only perturbatively. For example, if it's the phi to the 4 theory, that's like what the mouse is to biologists, phi to the 4 theory is to quantum field theorists. So even the simple case of phi to the 4 theory cannot be completely solved, can only be done perturbatively. Let us set W equals 0. Let us just look at the free Klein-Gordon field. Then what you can do is you can Fourier transform this differential equation here so that this Laplace operator here becomes multiplication and multiplication operator. You get the k squared over here. And then remember that in previous lectures, we already calculated what the wave functional is, at least for the ground state. And we found that it's a certain Gaussian. And we calculated that with phi to be input in its Fourier representation, with the phi k. We calculated what the wave functional is for the ground state of the Klein-Gordon field. So you could plug in the phi k, and you get out the complex number. So I leave it to you as an exercise to do this. Go back in the lecture notes and check the expression that we got for the wave functional for the ground state and see if it obeys that Schrödinger equation. I sure hope it does. And if you're ambitious, you know, find another solution. Find one where some excitation is present, where one of the mode oscillators is excited. Shouldn't be too hard. No, just put it into a box, then you have a discrete set of modes. Once you've done the Fourier transform, these modes decouple from each other, so you have really a functional Schrödinger equation for each mode separately. And we have the ground state solution, but of course, you can easily look up what the solutions are for excited states of the harmonic oscillator. And each mode really has just an ordinary differential equation, not even a functional one. So if you wish, you can pursue the project for the course using the functional Schrödinger equation and this way of solving things. But you can also do it the operator way that we will work with most of the time in this course. But I think it's quite intuitive to do it this way. Once you get, once you wrap your mind around what's going on, then I think it's a relatively straightforward way of doing things. Example two, another application of the functional differentiation. And that's the functional Legendre transform. Remember, we will need the Legendre transform to go between the Hamiltonian framework, which is ideal for quantization, and the Lagrangian framework, which is ideal for checking general covariance. And it's more than just checking. We will need to find out, in particular, what the canonically conjugate variable to phi is. We should not expect it to be phi dot when space is curved. But what is it? And for that purpose, we will need to make sure it's covariant and have a proper definition of canonically conjugate. And that's why we will need to go back and forth with the Legendre transform to check covariance here and that it's a canonically conjugate over there. So the key motivation is to determine what happens to this equation. In Minkowski space, we have that pi hat is phi hat dot. We should not expect this to be true in curved space. Here's the problem. You see, time is a preferred coordinate in the Hamiltonian formalism. But the formalism that we will use must be coordinate system independent in order to fit general relativity. So for example, let's say pi hat is the time derivative of phi. And then let's say we take the freedom of just reparameterizing the time variable. General relativity will allow us to do much more. We can actually mix the x and the t variables whichever way we want, as long as it's invertible. General diffeomorphisms are allowed. But let us just use, just for illustration, to keep things simple, let us just reparameterize the time variable. If we do that, so we go from a time variable t to a time variable tau, then we have the option. We could either say that pi is d by dt of phi, or if we like the time variable tau better, then pi could be d by d tau of phi. Are they the same? No, of course not, right? If pi is d by dt of phi, then it is the same as d by d tau of phi times the chain rule factor. So that already tells us that there's a difference between d by dt of phi and d by d tau of phi. There would be two different notions of canonically conjugate field. So we will have to somehow sort that out. There needs to be a unique and covariant way of identifying what the canonically conjugate variable should be to phi. Because remember that in general relativity, there is no preferred time variable. So it's not like we are just cooking up some other tau. No, you don't even know what t to start with. In a generic curved space-time, there is absolutely no preferred time variable t. So our strategy is going to be this. A little bit complicated. It looks a bit like a maze, but let me try to explain how that orbit works. On this side, we have Hamiltonian theory. On that side, we have Lagrangian theory. Now, it's the same theory. It's just another way of formulating it. So here, everything is formulated the Hamiltonian way. Here, everything is formulated the Lagrangian way. And the starting point will be first quantization in the Hamiltonian formalism. So we will have the phi and the pi fields on Minkowski space. It's just special relativity and first quantization. So it's just the regular Klein-Gordon equation, phi and the pi, in special relativity. Then we'll do a Legendre transform. And the Legendre transform keeps us in special relativity. It's still first quantization, but now we have it in the Lagrangian way, which means that we can now express everything in terms of the action. And the action is scalar in space-time. There will be a natural way to generalize at this point to general relativity, because that is covariant by nature. The action is a scalar. So we can arrange for the terms in the action, the Lagrangian, to become covariant, basically by turning ordinary derivatives into covariant derivatives. And so that then at that point, we have a general relativistic formulation of a Lagrangian theory, which is still not second quantized. Still, the fields are just number valued. Okay, but then we do a Legendre transform back. Legendre transform back to the Hamiltonian formalism. Now we are on general relativity's turf. It's still first quantized, but it's in the Hamiltonian formalism. At this point, we will have found out what the canonically conjugate variable to phi is. It's not going to be phi dot. It's going to be something more complicated. And once we have that, once we have the canonically conjugate commutation variables phi and pi, we will impose the canonical commutation relations and thereby go to the second quantized theory. And that's really what we want. And from that, we then can calculate the inflationary production of the CMB fluctuations and Hawking radiation and all those things. There is an alternative way, and I'm planning to cover that as well, also not with that much emphasis, because really the literature is always going this way. Even though it looks a bit like a detour, it's sort of the safest thing to do. But there is another way to do these things, which is to keep the Lagrangian side of it. So we have the action, quantum field theoretical action. Just the classical field theoretical action. We haven't quantized it at this point yet. So all the fields are still number valued. And then instead of going to the Hamiltonian and then quantizing with commutation relations and having operators in Hilbert spaces, no. There's another way to do it, which is to go to the path integral formulation that goes back to Dirac and Feynman. And then from the path integral formulation of quantum field theory, we can also calculate everything, but it will be with very different methods than if we started from here. The equivalence between the two formalisms is established by the so-called Dyson-Schwinger equations. And we will do this towards the end of the course. But this will be the main approach. The reason, I think, why the literature goes this way and why we will go this way is that really only in the Hilbert space operator framework approach to quantum field theory can we have a complete discussion of what the vacuum state in a four quantum field in curved spacetime should be. It's hard enough, and we can't completely answer the question even if we do it this way. But if we did it this way with the path integral, then it's even harder. It's very difficult to do that in this approach, because there is no Hilbert space if you do it with the path integral. There is no vacuum state to start with. And it all boils down to simply finding boundary conditions for Green's functions. And there is less intuition for choosing the correct boundary conditions for Green's functions, then there is intuition for choosing the correct vacuum state in Hilbert space. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll start with special relativity, go from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian formulation, and then the Lagrangian formulation we will upgrade to general relativity, and then we'll go back to the Hamiltonian and quantize that. So the Legendre transform is going to be very important because it interpolates between Lagrangian and Hamiltonian formulation. Okay, let me remind you of the Legendre transform. Assume we're given a function f of u, and let us assume it is convex. It could also be concave, but let's assume it is convex, meaning it doesn't wiggle like that. It's, you know, has this shape, and in particular, what it means is that, and that's really the key condition here, it means that if you know the derivative of the function, you can tell what the amplitude is. You see that? You see, the derivative is changing. It doesn't have the same derivative at any two points. Therefore, you can localize a point, you can identify a point by saying it's the point where the derivative takes such and such value. Okay, that's what it means. The derivative itself is monotonic, strictly monotonic. Okay, so you can nail down a particular point on that graph by just saying, I don't tell you what where we are on the x-axis, I don't tell you where we are on the y-axis, I just tell you the slope is this, the derivative is this. And then you can just check, this is where that slope is reached, unique, right? Because each slope is obtained only once. Okay, so let's assume we have a function like that, convex. You know, it would also work this way, but this is the assumption. Then for this function f of u, we define a new variable, w of u. And it is the derivative. Okay? So remember, if you know w, you know where you are on the curve. Okay. So we assume that this equation can be inverted. This gives us the slope as a function of u, the slope as a function of u, but as we said, we want it to be convex. That's another way of saying that we want that this equation can be inverted so we can get u of w. Somebody gives you only the slope, you can tell where on the u-axis we are. So we define the derivative and then assume that this relationship between the derivative and the amplitude between w and u can be inverted so that for any slope you can tell where the amplitude is. Okay. So we assume that the second derivative is larger than zero. The derivative is strictly monotonic. That will guarantee this. Then the Legendre transform of f is defined as a new function g. But the new function g doesn't depend on u. The new function g depends on w. It depends on just the slope. So the Legendre transform, abbreviated LT, maps a function of u into a function g of w in the following way. G of w is w times u of w minus f of u of w. Right? Remember, we said that given the slope, you can calculate what the u coordinate is. So the right-hand side is entirely just a function of w, because u can be expressed in terms of w, and therefore also f of u becomes a function of w. The Legendre transform, as I'm sure you know, comes up all over the place. It comes up in thermodynamics. It comes up between Hamiltonian and Lagrangians. And in quantum field theory, it comes up also in various different circumstances. Also, the Legendre transform can be viewed as the stationary phase approximation to the Fourier transform. In fact, if you're interested in that, I'm going really off on a tangent now. Quantization is mathematically completely equivalent to performing a Fourier transform. What I'm saying is that if you have a classical action and you want to solve the quantum theory to that, all you have to do is a Fourier transform. If you want to see that in more detail, I'll show you after class, immediately after. The Legendre transform is if you start with a classical action and want to know the classical solutions, that's obtained through a Legendre transform. The Dejeuner transform is a stationary phase approximation to the Fourier transform. I wrote a paper about that too, if you want to read up on this. But we will need the Lejeune transform for a particular purpose. What is very important is that the Lejeune transform, when performed twice, gets you back to where you started. Let us prove this. Let us define a new variable. So we perform the second Lejeune transform, right? We had one Lejeune transform. It took us from F to G. F had the variable U. G has a variable W. And then that was the definition of G. Now we perform another Lejeune transform on G of W. For that purpose, we have to first introduce a new variable again, namely the derivative of G with respect to W, right? So the derivative of G with respect to W is V. Let's just call it V. And again, we have to assume that this is invertible, that we can express W in terms of V. And once we have the new variable, we can then use a similar formula to this to get another function, which is now a function of V. However, let's find out something more about this V. It turns out that V is U again. So by defining, and that's the clever, that's why it was so clever to define the Lejeune transform this way. If we differentiate G with respect to W, we actually get the original variable U again. Here is how that comes about. We take V of W, which is defined as the derivative of G with respect to W. But G was this. G is this. It was the Lejeune transform of F. So let's carry that out. We have d by dw of this gives us two terms. One of them is just the u of w. The other one is where we keep the w, and then we have the derivative of du by dw. And here we have minus df by du, du by dw, chain rule. And then we see that this, by definition, was w. And so that term matches this one, except for the sign, so they cancel another out. And so we are left with just u. This is a reflection of the fact that the Fourier transform also gets you back to where you started. Okay, so what we obtain is that the new variable v is actually the old variable u. Now the square of the Lejeune transform gives us now this sequence. We go from f of u to g of w to h of v. H of v is given by new variable times old variable minus the old function. Remember, this is how the Lejeune transform is defined. The Lejeune transform is given by new variable times old variable minus the original function. So we do the same thing here. New variable times old variable minus the old function. But v is really u, as we just established. I mean, numerically coincides with it. Times w minus w of u. W times u minus the old function f. This is the old function, the previous function g, but we express it in terms of its what it's the Lejeune transform of. These two terms go away and we get f. So not only does the second Lejeune transform get you back to the original variable, it also gets you back to the original function. Very useful. It means that the Lejeune transform that gets us from the Hamiltonian to the Lagrangian also gets us back. Okay, here's an example. Consider a function of three variables, a, b, and c. For example, a times e to the power bc. Let us find the Lejeune transform with respect to b. So we will treat a and c as mere spectator variables. They might as well be fixed numbers. We are just Lejeune transforming with respect to b. It's going to be important, that concept of spectator variables, because later on, one variable will be a spectator that you might not expect to be. So, we take this function of three variables, f of a, b, and c. We do the Lejeune transform from b to a new variable beta. Okay, we Lejeune transform with respect to b. Then we obtain a new function, the Lejeune transform, which will depend on the two spectator variables, a and c. We didn't do anything about them. But the variable b became the variable beta. How do we do that? Well, we have to differentiate our function f with respect to the variable with respect to which we want to do the Legendre transform, which is b. So the beta is a function of a, b, and c. The derivative of f with respect to b, and concretely, it's this. Right? I just differentiated this with respect to b, got the c down. That's that. We need to invert that now. We need to be able to express beta in terms of b. Sorry, we had beta expressed in terms of b. Now we need b expressed in terms of beta as well. We can do that a little bit with the logarithm here, and here we go. So now we can express the full Legendre transform. So the Legendre transform of the function f of a, b, and c is given by g of a, b, beta, and c, where this is the new variable beta times the old variable, but the old variable expressed in terms of the new variables a, beta, and c, minus the old function where, well, it used to depend on b, but b is no longer legal. We have to express b in terms of the newly legal variables a, beta, and c. And explicitly, that's what it is, new variable times old variable minus the old function, and this is what you get, just as an example. If you like, do the Legendre transform again to verify that you get back to where you started. Now, what if we have countably many variables? In this case, we might have a function of countably many variables. The Legendre transform gets us to Legendre transform with respect to countably many variables. If we want to do a Legendre transform with respect to all of the variables. So we define for every u a Legendre transform partner, a w. It's going to be df by du. And then we assume that we can invert what we get. So we get the u also expressed in terms of the w. And remember, it's not one-to-one. It's not that the u3 is determined by the w3, right? The u3 is going to be determined by all of the w's, and here similarly. This is generally going to be some nonlinear map from Rn into Rn. And then we define the Legendre transform with respect to all of those variables in this way, that the new function, the Legendre transform function, is given by, because we do a simultaneous Legendre transform with respect to all of those variables, the sum over new variables times old variables minus the old function. We may, if we want to, allow also, why do I need to know that? Okay. All right. So we may also allow for spectator variables that simply go along for the ride but are not being Legendre transformed in any way. I should also say that some people define the Legendre transform with odd minus signs at places. And then what that does is that it can turn the Legendre transform into a map that doesn't get you back exactly to where you started, but only up to a minus sign, which is actually the definition that's closest to the Fourier transform, because it too gets you back only to where you started up to a minus sign. Now, what we will need is the case of uncountably many variables. So we have a function L now that depends on uncountably many variables. And it's going to be mapped with a Legendre transform into a function of uncountably many variables. We have to define the Legendre partners of our original variables. We do that by functionally now differentiating df with respect to the old variables. Remember, we could have some spectator variables that we don't touch. And then we assume that this relationship w of x as a function of the u of x, we hope that this is invertible, and so that we can have u of x as a function of the w's. If we have that, then, and this is expressed with maximum tedium here, I'm spelling out all the curly brackets, then g of w, g of all those variables, is given by this expression, which is again just the new variables times the old variables expressed in terms of the new variables, w, minus the old function, where in the old function, we have to replace the old variables by their expressions in terms of the new variables. If we do this, we still have that the Legendre transform applied after the Legendre transform gets us back to where we started. Let's apply that to classical mechanics. So assume the Hamiltonian H of Q and P is given. And let's say we have the Hamilton equations for arbitrary observables F of Q and P. Then remember that the time derivative of F is given by the Poisson bracket between F and H. If you're not so familiar with Poisson brackets, don't worry, we won't really need them after this in this course, but it's really useful to know about them. And so let me know, send me an email if you want my lecture notes on quantum mechanics that covers Poisson brackets and what role they play in quantization. So Hamiltonian equations for arbitrary F of Q and P are given by time derivative of F is given by the Poisson bracket between F and H, very similar to quantum mechanics, of course, where the Poisson bracket still exists but is represented by a commutator. And notice I was very careful in what I just said. I didn't say that in quantum mechanics the Poisson bracket is replaced by the commutator. That would be incorrect. In quantum mechanics, the Poisson bracket is still there. It's just represented as the commutator. Whereas in classical mechanics, the Poisson bracket can be represented through derivatives. You may remember that expression. It can no longer be represented this way in quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, you can represent it as 1 over I h bar times the commutator. Anyway, again, if you want to know more about this, not important for this course, but I have lecture notes on that. So assume the Hamiltonian is given. The Hamilton equations come out like this. In particular, you may want to choose for F, Q. You may want to choose for F, P. And then you get that Q dot is dh by dp, and P dot is dh by dq. All of this is in classical mechanics. So the point is, we have a function of two variables. The input for our Legendre transform is this. We have a function of two variables, h of Q and P. And we will Legendre transform it to a new function L of Q and B. In other words, we will do a Legendre transform where Q is a spectator and the variable P is going to be Legendre transformed. We will do not only a Legendre transform, we will also keep track of what happens to these equations of motion. Okay, but the main thing is the Legendre transform. We will do a Legendre transform starting with h of q and p, consider q a spectator, and then Legendre transform with respect to the variable p. This is what will get us to the Lagrangian, which will then be a function of q and b. So for example, and of course, we will then identify the b with q dot. But on curved spacetime, let's not be so quick. Okay, so for example, in ordinary quantum mechanics, the Hamiltonian might take this form, and the equations of motion are, you know, the usual ones. I don't have to spell them out. But my point is that the Legendre transform of H, where Q is a spectator and P is the variable that is being Legendre transformed, works this way. We take the derivative of H with respect to P. That gives us the Legendre transform partner variable to P. Let's call it B. It is dh by dp. As it happens in quantum mechanics, this turns out via the equations of motion to be q dot. So therefore, our B, we will be identifying with the q dot. But in principle, as far as the mechanics of the Legendre transform is concerned, B is its own variable. So the Legendre transform of the Hamiltonian is a function of Q and B, which by virtue of the equations of motion, which are really a separate issue from the Legendre transforming business, I can also be written as L of Q and Q dot. And this is the new variable. I should really write it, or could really write a B here, the new variable times the old variable P, but the old variable has to be expressed in terms of the new variables Q and B, minus the old function H, which is the function of Q and P, but P has to be expressed in terms of the new variables, which are Q and B. Well, and then the proposition is, and if you haven't done this calculation yet, you really need to do it, show that the equations of motion behave under the Legendre transform in this way, that the new equation of motion is this, where of course this is the B. All right, so for example, very quickly, the Hamiltonian might be that of a harmonic oscillator, then the Legendre transform gets us this. The only thing that changes is a minus sign here. Keep in mind that the Legendre transform really would give us here B squared. It was the equations of motion that identified that B is Q dot. And then these two equations of motion become these two equations of motion. So in print, as you see, we have two equations of motion here, two equations of motion there, but one of them on this side happens to be the identification of B with Q dot. So really, I mean, we should write here B dot. Okay, now, application to classical field theory. CFT stands for two things. Classical field theory, but it's rarely, more rarely used for classical field theory. It also stands for conformal field theory. So we won't mean conformal here, just classical field theory. It's just the field theory before you second quantize it. So assume that the Hamiltonian H of phi and pi is given, and the Hamilton equation for arbitrary expressions in terms of phi, their time evolution is given by phi dot equal to this, commutated, not commutated, the Poisson bracket between F and H. We haven't quantized it yet. And the Poisson bracket between the phi and the pi is a Dirac delta, just like the Poisson bracket between Q and P is 1. The equations of motion for classical field theory are, of course, these, that phi dot is the h by d pi, and pi dot is the h by d phi. We will now perform a Legendre transform and see what happens to these equations of motion. So the Legendre transform for the field is now working this way. H depends on phi and pi, and the Legendre transform will be treating phi as a spectator, and the pi will be Legendre transformed into a new field, which we may call rho. So for example, the Hamiltonian could be this expression here. And then we would define the Legendre transformed variable to the pi as dh by d pi. But by the equations of motion, by virtue of the equation of motion that dh by d pi is phi dot, and the equations of motion, if you remember, in principle have nothing to do with the Legendre transform. The Legendre transform doesn't know that there's a physical theory behind it. This is a special case of the equations of motion. By virtue of the equations of motion, we can identify that with phi dot, but as far as the Legendre transform is concerned, it's a rho. And so the Lagrangian, this should be a rho, which really in principle should be a function of phi and of rho, is a function of phi and of phi dot. And it's obtained by integrating over the new variables. Remember, this is the rows. The new variables times the old variables, but the old variables expressed in terms of the now legal new variables, minus the old function, which is the Hamiltonian, but where the old variable pi is expressed in terms of the new newly legal variables phi and phi dot, or phi dot is really rho. All these steps look perhaps very tedious because on flat space there's really not much to be gained by doing it this carefully, but on curved space we will have extra terms popping up when we do it carefully like that. Okay, so then we find that the equations of motion the Hamiltonian side, and there were two of them, are equivalent to these equations of motion on the Lagrangian side. I wrote down only one, but the other one is implied. The other one is that rho is phi dot. Okay, so concrete example. Here's the Hamiltonian of the free Klein-Gordon field. The equations of motion that we obtain are that phi dot is pi, and that pi dot is this. This is the Klein-Gordon equation. And after the Legendre transform, the Lagrangian looks like this. Just plug in the expressions and you will find that this is so. And this then gives us also the Klein-Gordon equation directly. So the next step then, out of time. The next step then will be, if I just go back to this maze. Here we go. All right. So we went from the Hamiltonian formalism on Minkowski space to the Lagrangian formalism in Minkowski space. So we can now introduce curvature. And once we have that, we can go back and identify what the phi pi commutation relations are. Then we are in business with quantum field theory on curved space. Okay, that's it for today. Who wants to see how Fourier transform and Legendre transform are related? Okay. All right. That really goes a bit beyond what we, beyond the course, but first of all, okay. Imagine you have the Fourier transform. You want to calculate the Fourier transform EI omega t EI A of t dt. Okay. So let's say we want to calculate the Fourier transform of a function that takes this form. This typically comes up in quantum field theory. It's e to the power of I times the action. I'm just writing it here in terms of one variable. It doesn't have to be the time, just one variable, okay? And so you can see how this comes up in quantum field theory quite a bit. And let's call this e to the power of I b of t. Let's put a minus sign here, okay? So this is a Fourier transform. A little bit unusual because we write the outcome like that, and we write the function that we want to Fourier transform like this, but we can write any function like that because this thing could have an imaginary part, and so it doesn't have to be a phase.
Excuse me, on the left-hand side, you already integrated over t.
Oh, yeah, it's of omega, of course, yeah. It's of omega, okay? So that's a Fourier transform. Now, well, there should be 1 over square root of 2 pi. Now let's ask, for which values of t does the integrand contribute most to the left-hand side? Now you see, this integrand here could be highly oscillatory. And in stretches where it is highly oscillatory, it's not going to contribute much. Basically, because if you integrate just E I alpha t dt, you know, it's basically vanishing for almost all alpha. So where the strongest contribution is to the left-hand side is where the phase is stationary. You see, when the phase is rotating very quickly, then we have destructive interference from one oscillation to the next. But But when the phase is varying slowly, that's when you get the major contribution. So that would be, so the largest contribution is where the exponent has vanishing derivative with respect to t. That's where it's stationary. So this is where d by dt of I omega of t minus I a of t, where this is zero. Okay? Which is to say, i.e. for w equal to dA of t by dt, right? And what is that contribution? Well, let's see. It would be that B of W is approximately, you know, where this is the value of just that one contribution. Let's just look at that one contribution where it's actually stationary. So that's where B of W is approximately, well, I B of W is approximately I omega t minus I A of t. Or let's remove the i's. Okay. At w equal to dA by dt, right? So what we've just established is that the main contribution to the left-hand side comes from the term on the right-hand side where the phase is stationary for a moment. And the value that we get for B is given by WT minus A of T, but the value of T that we have to choose is the value of T where this stationary phase condition holds. So it's where W is equal to dA by dT. So really, the left-hand side only depends on W because the right-hand side T has to be the T that obeys that. In other words, this is the Legendre transform of that. See that? It's because the new function is the, no, it's a new variable times the old variable minus the old function where the relationship between W and the new variable and the old variable is exactly this. So it's exactly our Legendre transform. Right. Who wants to know why quantization is a Fourier transform? You want to see that, all right? Okay. Now for that, I can really only explain it to those of you who already know about the path integral, because it really, we will cover it, but much later in the course, but maybe just to anticipate it a little bit. So. Quantum field theoretical action S of phi. So we have the action, which is the functional of the field phi. And then the path integral of quantum field theory looks like this. Integral I j of x phi of x. The path integrate over all phi. And this is then E I W of J. How many of you have seen this before? Oh, quite a few. Great. Okay. Now look at it. The Fourier transform. Right? What we say here is that this W, which is the generating functional for connected graphs, actually the whole thing here, the so-called partition function, is the Fourier transform of the exponentiated classical action, where this is just a Fourier factor. See, you can view x as a label again, and then you have phi of x is a variable, j of x is a variable, and you sum of all of them. It's just a product of so many Fourier factors. Right? E to the power of a sum is the product as well, right? So it's really just the Fourier transform with respect to all of the phi of x. So it's a continuously infinitely many Fourier transforms. That's what it is. And so if you do the Fourier transform of the classical, of the exponentiated classical action, you get the generating functional for the connected graphs. And if you know that, if you actually know those coefficients, if you write that out as a power series, if you can spell out what W is as a power series in J, the coefficients are the endpoint functions, are the endpoint functions. They give you directly the probability amplitude for certain collisions to take place. So basically, if you can work out that Fourier transform, you've solved the quantum field theory. So Fourier transform is quantization in that regard. And the Lejeune transform gets you to the classical theory. I leave it to you to figure that out. We just established that if you do the Fourier transform, and if you can actually carry it out, you have the generating functional of the connected graph, connected Feynman graph. So you've solved it at that point. If, however, you can work out the Lejeune transform, then you have the generating functional for the classical solutions. Just think about it a little bit. It works very similar to what we did there. And if you can't figure it out, let me know next time, I'll tell you. So basically, Fourier transform is the quantum field theory, and the Lejeune transform gets you the classical theory, gets you to the classical solutions. So classical solutions from the Lejeune transform, quantum solutions from Fourier transform. Or you may cheat and look up my paper on that. It's a paper with Jackson and Morales. Okay?